It was kind of this simultaneous philosophical question around wanting to create a world that's shared and interactive, that has consequences, has stakes, where the viewer becomes a player, the viewer becomes an agent, the viewer becomes not just immersed in the world in a filmic sense, but they have to make choices, they have to do things. Their actions can shape the world.
Hello, and welcome to the Culture and Technology Podcast, brought to you by the Vienna Business Agency. My name is Severin Matusek. I'm a writer and researcher based in Berlin. And today's guest is Alice Bucknell. Alice is an artist and writer based in Los Angeles. They use 3D game engines and speculative fiction to create artworks that imagine near future scenarios, taking the shape of video games, installations, and narrative essays. I was curious to find out more about their approach to worlding, and why the practice of imagining and prototyping alternative worlds is becoming increasingly popular. So I called up Alice in her apartment in Los Angeles to talk about their creative process and their thoughts on how alternative worlds expand our imagination. Not about what it means to live in the future, but in shaping the reality we live in today. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's a delight to be here.
I thought we could start the conversation by getting straight into talking about your work. I'll play 10 to 15 seconds of one of your earliest works, and then we can get into the story behind. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. Go for it. Sounds perfect. Yeah.
Okay. I'll start with E2C Crypto Build from 2020, which is a work I really connected to because I feel like everyone who has been through 2020 on the internet would relate to that.
Imagine a world where you could live out on the open Pacific or the endless expanse of the Arabian Desert. A world of political and economic autonomy, of engineered and sustainable beauty. A world with opportunity around every corner.
To give a bit of context to our listeners, while you listen to this voice and the story, you see this amazing computer-generated world, somewhere in the Middle East, little islands, very utopian, but very real at the same time. And they are worlds. I feel like your work is creating worlds and inventing worlds, speculating about possible futures, while at the same time giving this sharp and precise commentary about the present. So can you tell us a bit about that specific work, how it came about, how you created it, what the intention behind it was?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you're definitely right to locate Easy Crypto Build in pandemic era. Like it was sort of peak pandemic in a sense. I finished the work in the summer of 2020. So right when everything was popping off. And the work really deals a lot with connections between crisis capitalism, or as Naomi Klein has called it, disaster capitalism, sustainability, and architecture's complicity in the climate crisis. I was taking a page from my pre-artist history as a architecture and design journalist, where I was going around to a lot of building launches, press openings, kind of trying to understand the ways in which architects were sort of gilding or manifesting these worlds inside of their projects, looking at the language strategies they were using to describe these worlds as much as the sort of material techniques or tactics of world building for them. One thing I did really notice a lot, whether that's project opening in like Sharjah or Dubai or like London or like New York, is this real sort of complex, I feel like, within architectural visions or discourse to sort of be this enterprise in selling a better future. The buildings themselves are this sort of manifestation of a future world where carbon is successfully captured. Everything is sustainable. The building is this like neat, clean, perfect machine. There's this drive, I guess, or vision for a sort of architectural utopia that's super scalar too. I mean, I was looking at, you know, my own experience going to individual building press releases, but then also looking at how the architecture of Silicon Valley kind of dials this up to an extreme. I mean, you look at projects like the Apple Ring, right? Designed by Norman Foster and partners, like Heather Wicks, like Google Compound. It's this sort of architecture that's so massive in scale, like it's almost designed to be seen from outer space. There's almost this architecture for drones type complex. But then also all these buildings have their own sort of political and ecological agendas too. The landscaping inside of the Apple Ring is supposed to cultivate this primordial Californian ecology. It's designed by Laurie Olin, tied to the Olmsted brothers, for any like landscape architects nerds in the audience. So it's supposed to be this sort of proto-human Californian ecology. So the design brief was to sort of conjure a world free from humans, or like pre-human, pre-colonization. So like Apple could kind of situate itself in this like utopian futuristic vision that's also backwards leaning, right? That's like scraping or like seizing a sort of historical utopia and importing it into the present. In a nutshell, the project is sort of looking at architecture's relationship to the climate crisis. The relationship between sort of dystopia, utopia, especially like in the pandemic, and connecting all of that with cryptocurrency as a similarly escapist thing.
So you mentioned at the beginning that you had a life prior to being an artist as a design and architecture journalist.
Yeah.
So how did that transition go? And how did that background in architecture and design lead you to that specific creative expression that you choose by using game engines to create these worlds?
That's a super good question. I feel like I like to think of EZK as my soft launch into being an artist, because in many ways it's this weird hybrid of tactics and interests and approaches I was taking as a journalist or a writer, and then emergent interests I was having as a filmmaker, an artist, and world builder. If you look at the kind of history of my work, EZK came out in 2020. I roughly make one project a year. Swamp City was 2021. The Mars Project is 22. And that now the Alluvials is 23. And with each project, I think I'm getting further and further away from my critical muscle memory as a critic, or like as a writer. All the projects have multiple worlds in them, really. It's kind of this stacking and a constellation of different possible futures or pasts. I think it's also taking a page from a lot of speculative fiction writers, Octavia Butler, Ursula Le Guin, also people like Sadia Hartman, who proposed this idea of critical fabulation, which specifically deals with narrative world making that's past oriented. But like to kind of take a page from all of them, you know, like this idea that like the past is equally important to think about, like when we speculate, it's not just supposed to be this linear trajectory into the future, thinking about alternative futures. It's also speculation as a strategy can be this really beautiful space to unpick and reexamine narratives that we just onboard from the past. So I guess all this is to say, the more I make work, the more I stray away from, in a sense, just the criticism or like just the history of my role as like a design critic or architecture critic. The reason I moved away from all that in the first place is because I wanted to do something that wasn't just a critique or like an analysis or digestion of systems that already exist or people or buildings that are already out in the world, but to actually kind of do something more generative, I guess. Working in game engines, of course, this term like world building is thrown around so often these days, but it's such a kind of literal petri dish for generating these worlds. As my practice has evolved, like I've become like much more interested in the sort of like generative capacities of world making. And not to say that I'm like throwing out criticism, but I think that like you have to do more than just criticize right now.
I would say from my perspective, I really enjoy these two layers, the super creative, imaginative, speculative layer of world building. But then I think through the narration, you can definitely recognize this critical background. I really enjoyed watching these works because they're both very spot on, but also very humorous. I only watch these works online, but naturally they are in an exhibition space. So people go into a gallery, put on headphones, watch the entire thing. What is your desire the average visitor takes home from watching one of your works in a gallery?
Yeah, good question. Pretty much all the installations I do have a kind of architectural language to them. Like there's an architectural vision for the installations. I'm also perfectly happy for people to just snuggle up in bed with their laptop and watch a film of mine.
Okay, so it doesn't have to be in an exhibition space. It's totally fine to consume it online on your home screen.
Yeah, I mean, it's a different vibe for sure. There's certain projects, Swamp City, where like there was this full-on architectural installation at a gallery in London called Hoxton 253. I guess that was 2022. We turned the gallery into this sort of pseudo real estate office. Just to give like a bit of context, Swamp City is about this speculative real estate company called the Evergreen Group and eco-tourist developer called Swamp City that is building this sort of high-tech eco-tourist retreat in the Florida Everglades. It was sort of, again, looking to similar themes of architecture's role in like selling these utopian visions of the future, but also simultaneously exacerbating the climate crisis, like even as it's vending the opposite or claiming to do the opposite. But yeah, like that installation was basically like a mock real estate suite. Like we like turned the gallery into an estate agent with fake property listings on the windows. There was different like brochures you could pick up inside. The film itself was screening in the back. But for all intents and purposes, like it looked like an estate agent and like people came in being like, where are these beautiful properties? Can I get more information? Or like, can I talk to a salesperson?
So world building in the physical world as well, in addition to the virtual world that you built?
For sure. Yeah. And I mean, the Mars Project too is another example because it's like a triple channel installation. So you could watch it on your laptop at home, but you're definitely not absorbing the full world. The installation is these three monitors, lots of kind of Martian looking sand on the ground, like a custom light sequence that changes color based on which world the film is currently in. It's definitely more like immersive and a fleshed out world, I guess, like in situ. But I also like the idea that someone could just have my video open in the browser and like be listening to the narrative as they like go about their day or like their online activities. Cause I mean, the films are like non-linear, right? Like you could sort of drop in and drop out at any time. So it's more about capturing a sort of vibe or affect, I would say, than literally like being super dogmatic and like listening or watching the work unfold from like beginning to end. That's like not so important to me.
You mentioned that world building or world making has almost become a buzzword nowadays. Like so many people talk about it in the last few years, especially in the art world. Why do you think that is? Why do we have a desire to explore alternative worlds today?
God, that's such a good question. I would say it's a question of affect and it's a question of technology. I think like in the pandemic, we all became really good systems thinkers kind of overnight. And that was like a really interesting moment. I feel like with the sort of collapse of this mimed concept of like social, geopolitical, ecological order or structure or safety, the sort of illusion that all these things, these systems were just like working fine, working as usual, that just like crashed overnight, basically. And I think like in the sort of void that collapse produced, there was like some really exciting, I mean, as painful and like traumatic as the pandemic was, there's something quite beautiful about being so destabilized collectively. Talking about like Anthropocene discourse, there's this idea that like the apocalypse is already always ongoing. Obviously for people in the global north, much of the consequences of global warming is not yet tangible or recognizable to us. Or economic extraction, like capitalism, like globalization, all the kind of matrices of the Anthropocene. Most of the kind of bad effects are like not visible to like those in the global north, whereas like those in the global majority like have been experiencing like the most extreme bouts of climate related disruption, although they're the ones who are like historically and currently like polluting the least. The pandemic was an interesting moment where for a brief fleeting moment, no one was safe. Right. I mean, there were like, you know, like all those people like taking a cruise to like get away from like pandemic island or whatever. But then the coronavirus like still like getting on the ship and then like everyone's like trapped on the ship, like really like horror movie, like snakes on a plane type narratives. There was this kind of moment of like, I feel like equalization, which prompted, I think, a serious sort of like hard look at like many of the systems we have in place that just like aren't working, that we were sort of like gaslighting ourselves into thinking we're still structurally sound. And I think like in the pandemic, yeah, that sort of pulling away from these inherited systems created a sort of space where people could look like really systematically, like across scales at these like superstructures and be like, actually, like this sucks. Like I don't want to live in a world that looks like this. So I think like in a sense, the evolution of worlding or world building, the kind of uptick in popularity in the pandemic makes so much sense because like people were actively watching a world collapse, a system collapse. And like the question, of course, that comes after that is like, okay, well, if not this, then what else is possible?
Yeah, I agree with that. And I have the feeling that in the first few months of the pandemic, I definitely felt this sense of insecurity, but also this sense of excitement. There were all these articles coming out like, wow, this is a unique moment in time. We can now reimagine everything. And it felt exciting for a time. But then 1 year, 2 years into the pandemic, there was this craving by everyone to just please go back to what we had before, because we just got tired. And I think right now, the feeling that I feel is that with climate change, with power structures in the world, conflicts, technologies, there's this sense of giving up. Like, these things won't change anyway. For example, if you look at the internet, the last 5 years, there was this sort of movement with crypto and Web3, and a lot of it turned out to be a scam, actually. And there was also a certain portion of it where people truly felt like they could change something, though. And I don't think many people feel that way still. I think there's a sort of coming down to the ground of, like, you know what? I don't think this will actually change. So I wonder if that's an effect also where people are like, if we can't change the world as it is right now, let's at least imagine alternative worlds. Would you say that's true?
I think that's a really interesting question. There's definitely like boom and bust cycles to cultural optimism or around the first few months of the pandemic. There's this sort of euphoria mixed with terror. The like window of possibility for imagining alternatives is like ecstatic. But then a year in, people are like, get me out of this shit show. Like, I want to go back. Like, I'm looking for an exit strategy. I think that that's like so valid and so true. But I also feel like whenever I'm feeling that way, I kind of find myself returning to a lot of ideas that are ironically coming out of like what looks in reality like a really bleak kind of place, like Anthropocene studies, right? I'm thinking about thinkers like Donna Haraway or like Anna Singh's like Mushroom at the End of the World text, you know, projects that locate themselves like at this like festering wound of the planets in the present, this kind of compost heap, as Donna Haraway has called it, where things do look so, so bleak. Their whole narrative is really this concept of like staying with the trouble, kind of understanding that like this is sort of like a shared world. This is a shared reality. To lean too hard into concepts of either dystopia or utopia is really not productive. And that's like also where I would probably caution some of the game engine type worlding or world building specifically type projects. Because like anyone who's played around in like Unreal Engine or Unity knows it's like so fun to build these worlds. And like visually, they're really stunning. Like to go back to your question around like, oh, would people in the 70s or 80s want to just like teleport? Would they want to like bail from their life and go somewhere else? I'm not entirely sure. I don't know. I couldn't speak for them. But I would say that in the present, visual draw, like the beauty and the like immersiveness of these worlds does create really easy escapist exit strategies. So I do think that like, even though I'm using this technology, like I think it's important to be sort of critical and like aware of that like ease of escapism. But then simultaneously, this idea of sort of staying with the trouble, staying with this planet, staying with this world that's sort of mutating and evolving in all of these kind of uncanny, potentially scary ways, like all the sort of ghosts and monsters of mass extinction, of global heating. We have to kind of like listen to these stories and like be with them, I think, like as painful and like difficult as they may be and as tempting potentially as like an exit strategy feels. The kind of importance of creating these narrative worlds that sort of reckon with the complexities of the present. And that's like why I really like the term worlding versus world building. And I know it sounds sort of like pedantic. It's like, okay, they're both verbs. They both have the word world in them. Like how different could they possibly be? But I do think that like language is such a kind of important tool, like in this process of world making. And like, if you look at the term worlding, like it has an entirely different history than the term world building, which is the term that gets used a lot when people are talking about like immersive entertainment or like Netflix or like video games, like the kind of building of a world inside of a game engine, which is usually a sort of top-down process. It's like a world that's contained. It has borders. I guess in the sort of like sci-fi canon, it's usually by like one author, one writer. Whereas worlding is this whole different ballgame. Donna Haraway uses it a lot in her writing. Historically, worlding comes out of post-colonial studies. Like it's a term that's been used since like the 60s. I think Gariatri Spivak was the first person to use it in an essay that was talking about like language and empire and talking about how like worlding and language itself, like as a tool of worlding along with like cartography, like spatial visualization, is this means in which like new cosmologies, new worlds are introduced and has been used as a tactic like by like colonial powers to basically like erase indigenous cosmologies and like historical, like older, more ancient worldviews, basically stamp out those worlds, like using the technology of worlding, like to create their own worlds. So I guess what I'm trying to say with all of this is like, the more particular we can be with our language, I think like the more meaningful these worlds become, but also the more collaborative they become and open-ended they become. Like worlding by its nature is this like constant process of ongoingness. Like it's the idea that like no world is like ever finished. Like it's never self-contained. Like it's multi-authored. I world, but like the mushrooms world and like the atmosphere worlds, like we're all kind of like in this like worlding matrix together.
I would love to play one more work, the latest one that you're currently working on called The Alluvials. I would love to talk more about the worlding process you apply when you actually create the video and the world. So should we listen to The Alluvials and then talk about that work?
Yeah, sure. Go for it. Sounds good.
Some say that the history of Los Angeles is the history of its water. It's not easy to see in the desertified present. Abandoned tower blocks caked with bone-dry deposits of spreading sand. Empty streets prowled by the American gray wolf, brought back from the cusp of extinction.
The Alluvials was definitely building off some of the approaches I was developing in earlier projects like Swamp City and The Martian Word for World is Mother. Just to backtrack briefly to move forward, Swamp City is a sort of eco-dystopian resort at the end of the world in the Everglades. But it's also narrated by three main characters, two of which are non-human. One's an alligator, one's a bald cypress tree, and then there's the architect. So this idea of spreading out a web of perspectives to create a world, but also a world that's multi-authored and multi-narrated, for me feels really important. And that was a practice that I picked up in Swamp City. How do you tell a story from three different perspectives? And what if the duration of the narrative is just understanding a system through these different viewpoints? With the Mars project, it was less narrative driven, although there were different narrators as well. But the idea was to create this trifecta of possible worlds on Mars. Again, the sort of tensions between the human and non-human perspective were really important. The Mars Project's worlds were Red Mars, Green Mars, and Blue Mars. Red Mars was looking at the stakes of terraforming, like Elon Musk-esque vision of a human's inhabiting Mars, turning it into a sort of backup planet or planet B for Earthlings. Blue Mars was looking at the sort of emerging extractivist resource economy, like a sort of interplanetary resource market that is actually happening, like in terms of kind of interplanetary law. Like I was speaking with like space experts for that project, like trying to understand like the legality of resource mining on other celestial bodies. Like, so not just Mars, but like the moon or like asteroids, which yeah, freakishly enough, countries, including like the US and the UK, China, the UAE, these countries are all passing laws allowing themselves to extract resources from other planets and sell them back to Earth markets. And then the third world on Mars was Green Mars, which looking at a future for Mars through the perspective of a Martian ecosystem, like a Martian plant intelligence. Basically, to take this sort of multi-worlding coming out of the Mars project, this multi-authoring or multi-narrating tactic coming out of Swamp City, The Alluvials was sort of an attempt to integrate both of those strategies into one project. But then also, The Alluvials is not just a video work, it's a playable game as well. The kind of umbrella analysis of the world at stake is essentially a vision of Southern California, specifically the city of Los Angeles, its relationship to the politics of drought and water scarcity that have historically shaped the region and will continue to shape it into its future. Looking at California's relationship to water through the perspective of both human and non-human characters. So in both the video work and the video game, the perspective of elemental characters like the Los Angeles River itself, as well as wildfire. These are all like very important perspectives that feed into the project. If anything, the river, the main character or like protagonist, I would say, in its capacity to be a sort of ghost or monster of the Anthropocene, like it kind of haunts both future and past visions of LA. The project flips all the time in like a very nonlinear way between speculative future visions of the city. There's narratives where the Hoover Dam and Lake Mead, where LA currently gets quite a bit of its water from, as well as other access points, have basically dried up. So like one of the narratives in the alluvials is like, there's this like water company called Aquarius that's like manufacturing synthetic water in order to kind of quench the thirsts of the masses in this futuristic version of LA. There is like a literal next LA that's like rendered by this like AI developer. For that narrative, I was like basically training these like custom image generating models on historical and future versions of the LA River. So like before it was channelized in the 1930s, like historical photography of it. And then also feeding the model images of like the Frank Gehry master plan to like revitalize the river. So basically asking the model to do like a time traveling constellation of visuals from both the river's past and potential future. And then using that as visual accompaniment to the narrative, which is, yeah, basically this like next LA, this like version of the city that's like been redesigned by an AI. The project is kind of weird because it's blending narrative fabulation, like this sort of fictional component. But then I'm also just taking image generation that I'm doing behind the scenes in real time and sort of using that to like scaffold the narrative.
It sounds like your work is deeply embedded in research. I mean, you really go to the deep ends of researching history and possible futures, etc. And also, I wonder, like, how does it actually work with Unreal Engine? How does it work with working with a game engine? You just sit down and design buildings? Can you talk us a little bit more through the actual creative process of creating these 3D worlds?
Well, I definitely still have dregs of the writer in me, I guess, because normally I start out like with the script writing. Like I don't actually start building usually until like maybe 3 to 4 months in to a project. Like if a project timeline is like a year long, then the first like 2 to 3 months is just like solid research. For the LA projects, like I was lucky enough to spend like half a year out here last year. So like I would literally just go to the Central Library in downtown LA every day. The first like couple months are like super research heavy. From the research, I'll start kind of extracting or rendering or creating these like potential pathways for narratives. So, like I'll start thinking about characters. I'll start thinking about systems. I'll start thinking about like environments. And then kind of once I start having a rough vision for these potential avenues the work can go in, that's when I'll finally go into Unreal and I'll finally start building. For anyone who's not used Unreal, it seems really complicated. But honestly, once you're in, it's like very intuitive. But my process generally looks like a kind of combination of working with asset packs. So these are like, you know, resources that you can download on like the Unreal Engine marketplace. So that's the kind of like macro scale building of the world. And then I'll usually work with a friend of mine, Fabian, who's based in Berlin, who helps with the kind of construction of custom 3D models. So for me, it's really important to dial up the speculative immersiveness of the world, this feeling that you're sort of caught between a recognizable familiar present and an extrapolated unfamiliar future or past. It's very important for me to have kind of icons, like architectural icons, within the work. You're kind of building the world using those, a mix of sort of prefab objects, custom-made objects. Then you're shooting the cinematics, which can take, well, many months.
The cinematics means basically you have your 3D world built and then you're just moving a camera through it, right?
Exactly. You're directing inside the world. You're creating different cutscenes. I like to vary the cinematics. I mean, just like any kind of film director would do, like you're thinking about composition, you're thinking about light, you're thinking about sequencing, then do the voiceover component. I have a friend based in Manila, Ken Yama, who has since 2021 scored all of my work. So the beautiful immersive hypnotic electronic music that you hear like throughout the alluvials. It's a 7-chapter video. So there's 7 different soundtracks, basically like one per chapter, one per world almost. That's done by Ken. So I mean, that's like sort of the run of the mill production process for my work in general. But I would say with the Alluvials, it's been really interesting, like new territory for me, because like I said earlier, like it's not just a video work, it's a video game. So for the first time, I'm introducing an element of interactivity into my work. Like you have to think about how a player moves through the world, like what actions they can do, who can they play as, what are the stakes of play.
When people can actually play in that world, how's the approach of worlding enacted in there? Could I, as a player, actively contribute to that world and become an author of that world?
Yeah, for sure. I had this like massive revelation over the summer. It kind of hit me that like to make any work that's could be called worlding, like it has to be interactive. There has to be a component of malleability to kind of have the sense of ongoingness, the sense of like worlds that are sort of continuously spawning and reseeding themselves, that are multi-authored, that don't have a beginning or end necessarily. The work itself has to be a game. Like it has to be interactive. I've been using Unreal Engine for years now and I haven't made a game. Like that's sort of strange. I should use it for what it's made for. So it was kind of this simultaneous like philosophical question around wanting to create a world that's shared and interactive, that has consequences, has stakes, where the viewer becomes a player, the viewer becomes an agent, the viewer becomes not just immersed in the world in like a filmic sense, but they have to make choices, they have to like do things, their actions can shape the world. So the level I'm currently working on is set in this dried up Hoover Dam that I talked about earlier. It's sort of this blending of fact and fiction. Like in my research, I was really interested in like desert ecologies, like looking specifically at the Joshua tree. Scientists studying the tree are basically noticing that it's tracking northward. And I'm sort of extrapolating on that. Like I'm imagining it's gotten so far that it's reached like the Hoover Dam. It has one surviving pollinator, the yucca moth. They're this kind of really beautiful but doomed love story, like example of extreme symbiosis at the end of a world. Anna Singh talks about this a lot in Arts of Living on a Damaged Planet, the sort of domino effect of multi-species extinction that creates these voids or these sort of ghosts, like in our understanding of the environment or like ecosystemic networks. Like if one player drops out, then it creates this sort of ripple effect where like other species that are dependent on it might also disappear overnight. To be kind of haunted by that daisy chain link of absence is to kind of stay with the trouble of a heating planet. To kind of face those ghosts is really important. Basically in this level, the Hoover Dam's dried up. It's populated with Joshua trees and the yucca moths. And as a player, you can either play as Joshua, play as a tree, or you can play as moth. So if you play as Joshua, you're basically having to get the moth's attention, like in order to be pollinated. So there's like an audio feedback loop, like in the game. So you basically have to like talk into the microphone and just to like get the moth to kind of come over to you. If you keep talking to it for long enough, eventually the moth will come over to you and pollinate you. Actually, the game's duration is infinite for this level. So there's no way to like beat the game or win this level. The landscape is completely different each playthrough. So there's like an aliveness to the world, which I really like, in the sense that, yeah, anytime you play the game, the layout of the Joshuas is totally different. You'll teleport from one to the next and it'll always be a different one that you're put into or you're asked to embody. And then if you're the moth, it's kind of like a take on first person shooter games, but I refer to it as like first person pollinator. Like I said, the game is never over. When you pollinate one, then a new challenge pops up. I like the idea of playing potentially like not being fun, or like the idea of like, oh, video games are supposed to be like pleasurable. They're supposed to be escapist. This moment where you like check out from reality, where you can like destroy a building or like burn down a city and there's like no consequences in real life. I actually think gaming can be the opposite of all those things. And a lot of like queer theorists in gaming like talk a lot about like how important it is to play and make difficult games, like games that are no fun, but also how games can be the space for thinking about like climate realities, the climate emergency head on.
My last question is related to the non-human aspect of looking at the world, that's closely connected to early this year, I spoke to James Bridle, who also researched the topic a lot, the end of anthropocentrism, if you want to call it that way. Like the concept that as humans, we kind of come to realize that we are not at the center of the world and nature is far bigger than we thought, than we can even comprehend. How does this non-humanness come to life in your games and in your approach?
I love Bridle's work so much. Ways of Being was such a beautiful text. The section they were talking about planetary intelligence for me felt like so beautiful and so important. But also this logical or like conceptual psyop you can do on yourself, which feels really psychedelic at times. But historically, the reasons why we as humans have considered them separate for so long is because we believe that we have exclusive access points to certain technologies, whether that's like computing or whether that's like a soft technology like language, but sort of use those advances or those skills or those technologies as a sort of leverage point to basically be like, oh, well, like this is what separates the human world from the non-human world. And this is why we by default have agency and authority to manipulate and modify the non-human world as we see fit. As we've sort of learned increasingly through more and more studies into like machine learning, synthetic intelligence, like AI, we're kind of learning that many of the conceptions we had around other species, they don't have a language, they don't communicate, is just wrong. Bridle's book is really beautiful because they kind of point out that like, okay, well, there's this like snowball effect where like once we learn that like humans do not have the exclusive ownership over language, like that other species speak to each other. Maybe they communicate in ways that doesn't look like language to us, like bees of the pollination dance, or like mushrooms might communicate using like electrical currents in like their root networks. Like it doesn't look like language. It's not spoken, but like it is there. There's this kind of like psychedelic kind of opening up effect where like, if like you realize that your conception around human exclusive intelligence systems is just wrong, then like it kind of forces you to see the world from a totally different perspective. Like a world in which like there is no hierarchy, a world in which every other form of life is like just as intelligent as we are. And for me, that kind of creates this like really beautiful opening up of a kind of shared affect that is super integral to worlding, like where you sort of notice and understand that like we're all sort of in this system, this matrix of this world together. So in my practice, like I like to sort of bring up these ideas. Like language is something that I'm drawn to a lot in thinking about human and non-human world. In the Mars Project, for instance, I wanted to create a language that's spoken by this alien ecosystem on Mars. And in my own forays and work collaborating with AI, like specifically language models in my project New Mystics, one thing I didn't mention is like a lot of my scripts are co-written with AI. Like I'll train them on custom data points. Like I'll feed certain texts into a custom model and then kind of co-write the scripts for many of the narrative worlds like of my work.
So that basically means you are feeding an AI a selected text that are not necessarily only written by you. And then you ask the AI to help you write it. So you write together because you fed the AI with the right language that you actually want to use and want the AI to use as well.
It's hard to explain. It's definitely not like me being like, write this script in the style of Kim Stanley Robinson. It's more open-ended than that. Oftentimes, I'm looking for things that don't make sense. I'm looking for text that's really destabilizing or strange or bizarre. I'm looking for ways in which the model sort of fractures or breaks or deviates or like moves off course. Moments almost like where the language capacities of the model start to break down and it becomes more like poetry than like any sort of like sober narrative. Like moments almost where the model starts to hallucinate is like the moments that I'm really interested in general. To go back to the Mars Project, maybe this will help explain sort of my interest in AI a little better. Wanting the landscape to have a language, I basically used a series of custom models to sort of create this hybrid language. It's a combination of Scottish Gaelic, a 19th century alphabet, Martian alphabet, hallucinated by a French mystic called Helene Smith, who believed that she could talk to Martians and would host these like seances in her apartment where she would sort of like communicate with the Martians, and some like proto psychologists came along and like listened to her having these like seances and like wrote basically decoded an alphabet from her communication with these speculative Martians. So like the Martian language, Scottish Gaelic, and the sound of Arctic wind. So it was this like three-way confluence of language. So for the first step, which was the written language, I combined the Scottish Gaelic alphabet, which has 18 characters. Weirdly enough, the same exact characters are missing in Scottish Gaelic as the Martian language. So both of them have 18 characters. They're the exact same 18 characters. Scotland and Mars have a really interesting connection in terms of mineral composites. The Scottish Highlands is the most similar out of anywhere on Earth to Mars. There's a lot of like interesting lore around the Highlands, their own sort of cultural attachment to Mars. First phase of this language construction is like combining Scottish Gaelic with this speculative Martian language. And then the interesting thing is, obviously, there's no recordings of Helen Smith like having her seances. There's no way of knowing what her language sounded like. And for me, that was really interesting because I was like, great, we have this written language. The affect of written language and like spoken language are so different. What kind of knowledge is capable of like being embedded in these worlds is so varied based on whether you read it or listen to it. I took the written language, that's this hybrid language between a fictional language and a dying language on Earth, and then used another custom model to basically train it to associate different pitches of the sound of wind with different letters in this alphabet. So it basically translates this fabricated language that's spoken by the ecosystem of Mars in my project. It translates this language into wind. So I'm basically using the AI as the sort of like ecological, linguistic hallucinator. There's like all this backend micro worlding that happens like inside of each project. I like my collaborations with AI to be sort of opaque, to be murky, to be weird, to not make sense really within like a human understanding of like what sense is or like what logic is or what sense making is. Like I love the idea of collaborating with AI to sort of create more chaos, basically, to like create language or knowledge systems that do not center the human, that are not there to tell a story meant for human ears. It was really important in the Green Mars world where it's narrated by this alien ecosystem using this like AI language for the story to not be legible to, or at least not all of the story to be legible to the human audience watching the work. So there's like moments where the spoken Martian language will be like playing, but then you might get like a word or two that appears in subtitles in English. You'll get this like sliver of information, this tiny, tiny, like microscopic piece of a story, and vice versa. Sometimes there'll be like an English voiceover with like Martian subtitles. You get these little bursts or access points into this like alien language, into this artificial intelligence, this alien intelligence. Really the story that it's telling itself, it's not meant for you. It's sort of meant for the ecosystem. I like to kind of use AI as a way of like decentering or like de-anthropocizing narrative worlds in general, I guess.
This was Alice Bucknell. Go check out their work at alicebucknell.com. Many of their video essays and writing on worlding is available online, which I can highly recommend diving into. This is the Culture and Technology Podcast, produced by the Vienna Business Agency. The Vienna Business Agency supports new companies, projects, and products that develop Vienna's creative industries further.